Hi, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. I've been nervous about this today. I talk a lot in my professional life, and it's not a problem for me to do that. I teach, so I get up in front of people all the time. But this really kind of hit me as something different. And I've done this before, but I don't know. I was really trying to figure out, you know what I wanted to accomplish, and really what I hope I can do is just be as honest as possible about what my story has been and some of the things I've learned along the way, and hope that maybe it helps one person, and that will be good enough for one day. And that's really what I whittled it down to. And so with that in mind, I mean, the goal is to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. That's, I think, kind of what the tradition is. And I'm happy to do that. My sobriety date is February 13, 2005. And you'll find out that I've been in AA a lot longer than that. But that was when I had my last drink. And what I think my story has been about as much as anything is really going through the ringer with alcohol and drugs, and somehow, some way, being able to survive what this disease can really do to somebody. Because I was on death's door many, many times. So I'll talk about that in just a minute. But I was thinking on the way over about how much detail to go into about my family and you know what it was like when I was younger. And I concluded that that's an important part of my story, not because I want to sit here and whine and cry about what happened, but because it became a part of who I am and how I react to things, and part of the inventory process. And this was very much how this came together. And a lot of my character defects and a lot of my reactions to life were formed when I was young, because I was constantly on the defense, waiting for the next attack. And so I developed a very powerful defense system around many different things. And that's been one of the things that I've tried to look at in my recovery. But if I go back, I can tell you a number of things that are certainly true. My father was an alcoholic and a very successful businessman. My mother was a drug addict, prescription pills, and appeared to be a very beautiful, altogether housewife on the outside. And if you would have looked at our family from the outside, looking in, you would have said, this is, you know, really a happy family. They have everything that you could possibly want. And in truth, if you would have gone into the house and seen the way things happened every day, it was much different than that. And it wasn't like it was horrifically violent and all those stories that you hear. But a lot of what happened to me was a lot more subtle. There was violence. That was frankly, in retrospect, that was easier than some of the other things that I was contending with. Because when you're in a house, and many of you know this, with an alcoholic parent or two alcoholic parents, it's like living in a house of mirrors. Nothing is the way it seems. And things get very confusing very fast. And I had to figure out a way to protect myself in the middle of all of that. And I did an adequate job, but it was tough. And my father was the kind of guy that would preach to me about the evils of smoking marijuana after he just drove home from the country club and drank 8 gin and tonics and almost knocked, you know, almost wiped out 3 people on the way who were jogging on the side of the road. This was just this repeated hypocrisy that just kept, you know, washing up on the beach every day, and I had to learn how to fight through that, and that was very difficult for me. I remember when I was in treatment, you know, they have these family weeks, and he would come in and he would, you know, talk about how I had been so irresponsible and had not behaved, and you know, how I was causing all these problems for the family. And, you know, the people at the treatment center would say, look, you guys need to get your secrets out in the open. We need to talk about everything here. This is the only way that you're going to all be able to find some recovery as a group. And I said, okay, you know, that makes sense. And so we all were talking. My dad was kind of quiet. We find out later that over the course of his marriage with my mom, he had had 9 affairs. You know, while preaching to us about honesty. And so this is the kind of stuff that I took with me. And I was, by the time I got out of all of that, I was pretty confused. And what ultimately happened is kind of cut to the chase. By the time I was 12 years old, I thought I was a loser, and I wanted to kill myself. And I would write letters to my father telling him just that. And I remember feeling this weight on me that was just a nonstop barrage of criticism and self-hate that I just couldn't shake. And this has been one of the most difficult things for me to deal with in my whole life and in my recovery. And I have ideas about why that became a pattern for me. Not sure that all that matters all that much, but I wasn't able to deal with it in a meaningful way until I got here. So after that, I was lucky enough to pack up my bags and go to a boarding school. I got to pick the boarding school I went to, and my decision was based upon 2 factors. Number 1, were there girls? And number 2, could I play hockey? And the answer to both questions was yes. Off I went, and it was great. And I'll tell you, my life changed immediately for 2 reasons. Number 1, the people there liked me, and I had never been in an environment where that was true. And I just felt so much better and uplifted just because of that. But the other part of it was the fact that I found alcohol really for the first time. And I had all this junk in my head. You know, all the insecurities of being a teenager, add all the crap for my family on top of that, and you know, I wasn't quite sure how to relate to people, certainly not members of the opposite sex. And I struggled, and I felt a lot of self-doubt just haunted me. And I remember we went to a party, and all the kids from the school were there, and we were drinking. And after about 3 or 4 drinks, all of that went away. All of it. And all of a sudden, I felt comfortable with people. I could talk to them. I could dance. I was like 12 Fred Astaire lessons in the bottle of vodka that I was drinking. It just changed everything. It solved everything. And what most people would relate to is that solution to all of my problems ultimately became one of the worst problems in my life, and it almost killed me. But at the time, I would have never seen that coming, and I didn't care. And off I went. And so after that, I went to school, to college. I picked University of Wisconsin. Again, my criteria were very, very stringent. It was, what is the drinking age? And it was 18. Off I went. And they accepted it. Anybody, as long as they're in the top 50% of the class. I was like 49. So I got in, and I came here, and I hit the ground running. And I was a full-blown alcoholic in my freshman year, without a doubt. I remember going to bed at night. I don't remember going to bed at night. I remember waking up in the morning with shivers and, you know, all of that, feeling like I was very sick. And I remember surrounding myself with people who drank like I did, so I didn't feel like it was a problem. And that's exactly what I did. And there were plenty of people to pick from here. And I joined a fraternity. I don't even remember the name. But I did. And there was a bar across the street from the fraternity, and we'd go there in our pajamas. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And I was cushioned and insulated from the reality of my situation for, I don't know how long I was in college, like 7 years or something like that. And there was nothing that could touch me, because really nobody cared. Nobody saw it that would have cared, and the people that did see it were doing the same thing. So I was in the middle of a cocoon. And I remember just kind of keeping it to myself and being real quiet about it, and I knew that I had a big, serious problem. I knew that somebody at 20 years old shouldn't be shaking so badly in the morning that they need to drink to feel better, or sweating so much that, you know, that their sheets were just soaking wet. And then literally that's what happened a number of times. And I remember, you know, a lot of crazy stuff, but I could write it all off to the college experience, right? I went to law school after that, and that was completely different. drinking and snorting cocaine does not mix well with the first year curriculum of your average law school. You can say that with certainty. At least it didn't for me. I could not keep up. And life started to fall apart. Because now I was in an environment where I was being challenged, and I was still drinking like I was drinking prior to that, and I couldn't, and it was going to have to be a decision on my part to either cut one of them loose, and I did, cut law school loose, and went to treatment for the first time, and got a deferred admission to come back the next year. They were really very cool about it. And so I went through that whole process. I came back to school. I finished law school. I did fine. And then moved on with my life. And when I graduated, got the diploma, and walked off of the stage, my dad was waiting for me with a car and an airplane ticket for me to go down to Arizona to go to treatment again, because things weren't going well. And he was afraid that it was going to really get worse. I was in the middle, I went to law school in Detroit, and this was right when crack cocaine hit the streets. And if there was a place where crack cocaine really hit the streets in the late 80s, it was Detroit. And I got mixed up in all of that. And things got pretty scary. I was way in over my head. I was not a tough guy. And I did not belong in that group, but I was caught up. And so I was taken out of that, and I went down to Arizona, and I went through a 30-day rehab, and then they suggested that I go to a halfway house in downtown Phoenix. And I agreed, and it was a 5-month commitment at least. And it was known for being a really tough halfway house where they didn't mess around, you know, they confront you and all that old school treatment stuff. And I remember going there and meeting with my counselor the first time. And I'm sitting in the office with him, and I look up at the wall, and there's a sign that said Rules of Recovery. It said, don't judge, don't analyze, don't criticize, don't defend. And he looks at me and he says, you just got out of law school, didn't you? I said, yes. And he says, yes. He said, you're F. And he was right. And he was also kind of wrong. I mean, that wasn't the whole thing. But I certainly, if I wanted to, could pull out a bunch of stupid skills that had no application in, you know, my real life. But I remember that conversation very well. What I also remember was that I went through that program. I worked my ass off. And I did everything that they told me to do. And then some. And I ended up staying for 6 months. And when I left, I was their poster child. I mean, they thought that I was off into the sunset and that I would be coming back and giving talks and I was going to be one of their heroes and, you know, advertising for them and all that. I was drunk 3 days late after I got out. 3 days late. And I was not thinking about drinking when I left that. I'll talk about how you get from point A to point B in just a second. But, you know, that was, you know, a pretty important part of my story. Because if you go back in time and you remember that alcohol was really the solution to my problem, now it clearly had control over me and command over my will in a significant way. And I was back at it. And this began a nightmare of about 8 years in and out of treatment. Since they have a wing named after my family at one of the treatment centers in Arizona, or a sandwich named after my mother at the cafeteria. But I also, you know, and I knew all that stuff in my head. I could just repeat it. I mean, it was good that I went. It saved me. It slowed me down. But that's it. I mean, it slowed me down. But I would end up, you know, 6 months sober, 9 months sober, a year, got 18 months once, and then, you know, it'd be 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. And all this time, I was going to AA meetings almost every day. And I just couldn't get my shit together. And I was, at least on the outside, working as hard, if not harder, than anybody in those rooms to try to figure out how to get out of this thing. And I couldn't. And, you know, I don't know why that was true. I don't know. How do you explain to somebody, especially an earth person, how do you explain to them I couldn't stop. No matter what I did, I couldn't stop. That does not make sense, but it was true. And what would happen for me is somehow something would build up, and all of a sudden it would explode, and I would be gone. And I would resurface a week later, often injured, sometimes in jail. It really varied, but it was never good. It wasn't like I won an award and then came back. I mean, things were shitty. And I was, I didn't care. And the problem was that at that point in time, I was haunted so much in my head with these thoughts that I've kind of shared with you, that for me, it was worth taking the risk to go get loaded. It was worth it. This is how I was calculating things. From the outside looking in, of course, it wasn't worth it at all. Objectively speaking, no. But in my mind, the risks were equal to, if not less than, the reward that I was getting. And the reward that I was getting was that I was getting out of these thoughts. And I was free for at least a very brief period of time. And it didn't matter if I ended up waking up in a crack house in South Phoenix or in a hotel room, God knows where. And, I could give you just countless stories of, awful, terrible, degrading experiences that I went through with cocaine and alcohol. And I'm not going to bore you with that. People a lot of times ask, what was it like? And, they kind of think that you're on a yacht drinking martinis and that, everything's good, girls dancing around. It had nothing to do with that for me. For me, it was about survival. And I was willing to put everything on the line to keep getting loaded. And I did. And there was a period of time where, contrary to current appearances, I was actually quite athletic and very good shape. I was very strong physically, and I became very violent. And this was not good. Because I would have three or four drinks, and you did not have any way of predicting how I would behave. And so I ended up going to jail. I ended up getting hurt a number of times very badly. I ended up hurting some people pretty badly. And, I still think about that. And I didn't belong in that world or in that life, but I was right in the middle of all of it. And I was prepared to die. So I would like to be able to tell you that some cathartic moment occurred where I finally saw the light, surrendered to God, the light went off, and we joined hand in hand and walked off into the spirit of the universe, and I've never drank since. That's not my story. My story was that I came back to Madison to go back to school for a while, and I was committed again to being clean and sober, and I had about a month or so under my belt, and I looked over my shoulder, and I had 3 months, and then I looked over my shoulder, I had 6 months, and a few months after that, I met my current wife. She must have been out of her mind, and then a year passes, and things are kind of starting to fall together. And then a year and a half passes, and I've got some things that on my plate that are worthwhile. And what I believe happened is that I developed and was lucky enough to have a life where I had things around me that were not mine, but that were given to me by God that enabled me to see that life was worth living and it was not worth going through that anymore. And I think the balance just went like this at some point in time. And it was over. Now, that sounds kind of goofy, but that seems to be the best explanation I can give you for how I got out of this. All right. Now, in the middle of this, I worked the steps a bazillion times. I'm still very dedicated to that, by the way, and you'll hear why in a minute. And I also was lucky enough to meet a number of people in AA who sponsored me and who helped me out and were very patient with my completely asinine behavior while I was coming in and out of the rooms and not apparently not making the commitment that was required. I don't believe that was true, but it sure looked that way. And they got very frustrated with me. So that was kind of, I think, how I ended up being clean. And what ultimately happened is I got married. I got a job teaching at the law school, which helped me because I like academics. And we had a girl, Megan, my daughter, who is 13 and is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, and I just love her to death. And I started to put together a career, and I was able to accumulate some time and distance away from alcohol, and it just kind of faded. And that's really been true for me. And I haven't, you'll see how lucky I am in a minute. But so to kind of cut to the chase, so I want to talk about recovery for a few minutes, but to kind of cut to the chase about my story, I was very lucky and ended up working at a prominent law firm in this community, and two, 3 years ago had a very difficult breakup with them that involved a lot of animosity and a lot of behavior that was very difficult for me to deal with, and that challenged me at levels that, you know, go back all the way to the hypocrisy I had to deal with my father. And I was challenged emotionally and intellectually and personally in ways I never imagined. And it was without a doubt the hardest thing I've ever been through in my recovery. So I come out the other end, and I start working for another firm, and I guess it was about 9 months ago, I had a stroke. I was in my office, I just come back from lunch, and just couldn't move my left arm, and so I was rushed to the hospital, and I was there for 6 weeks doing, you know, rehab with my leg and my arm to some extent, and, you know, trying to deal with some memory glitches and other issues. And I can't tell you how much respect and admiration I have for the people who do that kind of work, the physical therapists and the occupational therapists. They were amazing. They were just amazing. And they told me about a weekend that it was unlikely that I would be walking within the year. And they told me that it was unlikely that I would, you know, be able to pass the neuropsych test that would clear me to practice law again within the next year, maybe two. And I won't tell you what exactly I said word for word, but I told the doctor that day, I said, listen, I said, if this is true, I want you to load me up with every single thing that you have from the moment I'm here until the moment I leave. And I started waking up in the middle of the night and tried to practice walking around my bed. I drove these nurses crazy. I was literally obsessed with getting well. And 10 days later, I was limping. And 3 weeks later, I was walking. The point of that, which has nothing to do with alcoholism, is that if willpower had anything to do with recovery, I would submit to you that I have a lot of willpower. Because and it's not that I did it. I had a lot of help and got through it. But if I took that amount of willpower and multiplied it by 10 and tried to overcome alcohol when I was actively using, it wasn't even a fair fight. It wasn't even close. And so I ended up getting out of the hospital and moving on. And while in the hospital, on the hospital bed with my family there, the firm I was now working with had made me a partnership offer before the stroke. And I didn't know if I was going to take it or not, but it meant a lot to me. You know, it was kind of getting my feet back on the ground after all this bullshit that had happened before. They came in and delivered me a letter in front of my daughter, which said that they were rescinding the partnership offer because of my stroke, word for word. And now, it doesn't take a lawyer to figure out that that's pretty bad judgment. And for one of the first times in my life, I just walked away and let it go and didn't fight, even though it was served up on a platter really nicely for me to do. But those events of the past few years have taken their toll on me, which prompted me to start coming back more to AA, and thus my presence here and at the 5:30 meeting. And by the way, I really want to express my appreciation to people that I've got to meet and who have shared in those meetings. And I mean, this is a good group, I think. I really admire a lot of you, and I've learned a lot. But it's been hard, and I'm still trying to kind of get my footing, especially, you know, in this professional world where now I'm really not sure whether I trust many people at all. Okay? And I'm very much gun shy. You know, I'm like that guy, I don't remember that old show where he would dive under the, he had a army hat on, or not a hat, a helmet, and he would dive underneath the desk and yell, "Incoming!" It's kind of how I feel in my head, because I can't read things. You know, what they're going on around me, I'm not able to read them for what they are. I attribute meaning to them and act accordingly. And that's become a bit of a problem, and it's actually something that I'm been able to wind down a lot. But the point of this last few years and the difficulty that I've had and really the challenges that I face is that through that whole time, I really never once thought that drinking was an option. And, you know, I think that says an awful lot about recovery. Because if we go back in time to, you know, when I was really going through the ringer, everything gave me a reason to go back out and use. And now I had really good reasons, quote unquote, to go back out and use, and I didn't even think about it. How can anybody argue that this program doesn't work in the face of that experience? I think it does, and I think it did. And I think I've been very, very fortunate in that respect. Because I will guarantee you that there was a point in time, years and years ago, if somebody had come in and said, "Okay, Tim, we have a solution for alcoholism. All we're going to have to do is cut off your pinky. And if you let us cut off your pinky, you'll never drink again." I would have said, "Go for it." I would have. I know I would have. And that's how bad I was in trouble. So, in any event. So that's my story. There are other pieces of it that I can talk about a little bit later. But I do want to talk a little bit about what recovery means to me. And if anything, you know, kind of thinking in my mind about this talk tonight, you know, I was asking myself, you know, what really has meant the most to me in my recovery? And I think that I have to kind of go back to the period where I was going in and out and going to meetings all the time. And there were periods of time there where I was kind of grabbed by the scruff of my neck by various individuals that were in the meetings. And they weren't quite as polite as you seem to be here. They were much more forceful in their approach, especially to me. I think they figured, what the hell. I mean, so it wasn't touchy-feely. It was, you know, this is the deal. And so I learned a lot of things. And there are a lot of things that I really do believe to be true. And now if I share an opinion, just understand it's just mine. And it does not need to be yours. But I do have some thoughts. And I think that overall you're going to find out that, you know, I really do believe in my heart of hearts that this program is spiritual, and that's mostly all of it. I think about the first step, and I remember when I first got here. And I remember with a lot of people who I've met over the years who came to AA, and I could see they were at their first meeting or just getting involved, and they were wrestling with this idea of whether they were an alcoholic or not. Am I an alcoholic? So what's the definition of an alcoholic? How can I? And this kind of semantic game, right? And my sponsor told me many years ago, because it doesn't matter whether you're an alcoholic or not. We don't care about that. The question is are you powerless over alcohol? That's what you're supposed to admit in the first step. And there's a big difference between those two things. Maybe there's no difference at all, but we don't care about whether you're an alcoholic. And they were very clear about this. And he said to me, he said, "Look, let me ask you two questions. Number one, once you start drinking, can you safely predict when you're going to stop?" I said, "No, absolutely not." He said, "Once you quit, can you stay away from alcohol for a predicted period of time?" "Absolutely not." "Well, then you're powerless over alcohol." And if I was, for me, it was a no-brainer. But, I mean, that is pretty much, I think, the setup here. Because what ultimately happens is between point A and point B, there is a thought process that takes us from sobriety to drinking or to using drugs. And that happens when we're completely sober. So, I'll come back to that in a second. But the main point that I want to make at the beginning, and this is something that I was taught, is that there are really two parts to AA that you have to differentiate between. They overlap a lot, but it's important to understand that there is the program and there's fellowship. Fellowship is a group of people who meet together and share their experience, strength, and hope. That's not the program. The program is in the book. And the program is the recipe to a spiritual awakening that will alleviate the drinking problem. Fellowship is not. And I kept saying, I'm going to thousands of meetings, why aren't I sober? They said, because that's the fellowship. You know, are you going to get involved in the program? And I remember thinking about that, and I didn't like that not very much, but I think it's true. I think it was easy for me to hide behind the meetings and avoid doing the work. And these guys, where I was, they took people through the steps, and they took them through the steps quickly, and they were thorough, and they didn't mess around. And that was just the way they did it. I don't know if that was the right thing to do or not, but I sure learned a lot from that, and since then I've kind of had my own thought process around this. But the one thing that I relate to more than anything in the big book or in any of the literature is the idea of alcoholic insanity. Because I think that, you know, I said earlier, how did I get from point A, where I'm released from a treatment center after 5 months with a perfectly clean bill of health, to point B, where I'm picking up and using again? How do you do that? Well, I came up with something up here that justified that transition. And it can be anything. I used to represent people who were arrested for drunk driving a lot. And I get like this person with their fourth or fifth DUI. And I talk to them and say, you know, you think you might have a problem? You know, it's just kind of a recurring event in your life, and, you know, you're facing prison time, this isn't good. And I say, no, I have a problem. It's the cops, or it's my wife, or whatever. Right? It's all bullshit, right? But the problem is that if you hook them up to a lie detector, they will pass. I mean, that's the thing. And that's, I think, where they say it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. Because this thing has tricked me so many times. It has set up something over here and then hit over here. And I've just gotten beaten over and over and over again when I tried to bring my intellect and my will to the table against it. Now, that's the way it was for AA early on, historically. That's changed, right? I mean, a lot of people come to AA today and they don't have that experience, but they're on their way to that, and we can help them. I mean, that's a really cool thing. But back then, it was the last gaspers. These are the guys that had no other options, and they literally could not stop no matter what you did. They had to either be locked up or they were going to die because they were going to keep drinking. And that was Bill Wilson's story. And if you go back and look at the people that were involved in AA early on, they were, you know, they were at the point of death. And so understanding that there is no human power that can relieve the insanity of alcoholism, to me, is what the first step is all about. And it also implies what the solution would be. Power. Right? And if I don't have the power, that means I have to go elsewhere find that power to help me recover. And that power is generated, in my judgment, through the 12 steps. So that was what I was taught. That is what I believe. That's how I conceptualize this process, because I can complicate anything and just make it impossible. I need to make things simple. And that's the simple formula that I've used, at least to understand the first step, and then what the second step is about. Because what the first step does is identify the problem. Second step identifies the solution. And then the remaining steps are the practical program of action that is necessary to carry out the solution. That's it. And at the end of the day, it's step 12, it says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It doesn't say a result, the result. And you think to yourself, I didn't come here for that, I came here to get sober. Right? Who cares about a spiritual awakening? And the fact of the matter is that as I read this, if you're able to have a spiritual awakening through this process, however that's defined, individual, on your own terms, your own way, then sobriety will follow. And I believe that. And I think in a way that happened for me. It has certainly, in more recent years, been a bigger part of my consciousness of what recovery is. A lot of it I didn't understand while it was happening. And a lot of that stuff that these guys drummed into my head actually became a part of my kind of operating system years later. And it was they made a big impact on me. And I still think about them a lot, and I'm very grateful to them. So if a power greater than ourselves is the solution, then the next question is how do I find that power? And that brings me to step 3, where we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand it. That to me is extremely simple. And I used to complicate this to death, and I would say to myself, okay, I am turning it over right now. I close my eyes, turning it over, and then, it says made a decision. It's all set. And I think that if you make that decision, then there are a number of other things that you do in the remaining steps to carry that decision out. And somebody says, well, how do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? You work the rest of the steps. So, the God thing for me has been a struggle lately. And it's mainly because of the things that have happened in the last few years and dealing with some of the repercussions of that emotionally and trying to figure out how to go back into the professional world and feel comfortable about it. And I've gone back and forth about this whole thing with God and what it means. I carry around some guilt about this because I feel like I'm supposed to believe that there is a loving, caring God who is with me at all times and who is going to answer my prayers, maybe tomorrow, maybe in 100 years, but He cares for me and He loves me no matter what. Maybe that's true. That has not been my experience. And, I think it's almost forbidden to say that, but that has not been my experience. I believe in my heart that there is a power greater than myself. I believe it's here, and I think that it mainly consists of love and compassion and honesty. And I just kind of default to that because those three principles are a lot more powerful than anything I can ever come up with, and that's what I rely on. And I do believe that there is a God. I haven't gotten to the point where I see this huge presence in my life, positive or negative. But that doesn't change the fact that I know that a power greater than myself has been responsible for my recovery. And I've worked the steps a number of times, and one of the things that I've always been grateful for is the fact that I was able to do step 4 with a sponsor who really, really helped me. And I remember sitting down and starting that process and itemizing the defects and how they were impacting my life. And what ultimately I came up with or came up against was my ego. And the various manifestations of my ego and how that came after me over and over and over again and was certainly not an ally. And I mean an ego in terms of being more interested in succeeding professionally than being home with my kids, being more concerned about whether I get recognition and whether I'm helping people. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And ultimately, it comes down to a set of defenses that I have set up to protect me against that world that was so difficult for me when I was a kid. And I still have those defenses, and I use them all the time. The problem is that they are overreactive to whatever it is that triggers me, and they're not necessarily appropriate to the situation. I've had to really learn to wait before I react. I've had to, and I've become so much better at that. And I've had to learn to give somebody else's point of view or approach fair consideration instead of jumping to being right, being more important, things like that. And so what step four has been for me is picking away at these pieces of my ego that actually are all over me and fooling me about what is important in life. And one piece of that has been this constant self-criticism that haunts me in various degrees at any point in time. And I haven't been able to make that go away. But I have made progress, and I have inventoried it, and I've looked at it, and I understand, you know, conceptually why it's been such a difficulty for me. But ultimately, after step four, what I was able to do is just pinpoint a number of problems in step five and put them on the table and say, these are really the core issues that are driving my character defects. And mostly it was insecurity, fear of criticism, fear of rejection. It's a whole list of things that I didn't want to talk about. And so I get to step six and to step seven, and to me these are kind of the best kept secrets in AA, but they are so important for me is to be able to look at these character defects and to ask God to take them away. Now, there's only two things that we ask God to take away in AA from what I read, all right, from what my understanding of the program is, and that's our obsession for alcoholism and our character defects. And I can tell you that I have not been able to think my way out of my most pressing and difficult character defects. And one of the most prominent ones in the last few years and when I was younger was resentment. And resentments have been a killer for me. And resentments have been difficult because they take up my time, they take up my energy, they focus me away from what I need to be doing. There's nothing healthy about them. The worst part and the more difficult thing is a justifiable resentment, right? When I think I'm right and I'm pissed. And these things have occupied my mind and taken me away from God, from my family, from people that I love, and from even taking care of myself, you know, to the point where, you know, they have ruled my thoughts. And it's kind of bizarre to think about another person who you're mad at and don't like having enough power to rule and control your thoughts, you know, for a long period of time. But that's what a resentment is. It's giving control to somebody you're pissed at. And I'll tell you, I've been there and done that, and I have really been lucky enough to improve in that area. So then the steps eight and step nine and the amends to people. And I had some amends to make that were difficult, and there's still some that I could make. But I've done the best that I can with that. And that's helped restore some relationships and put things back on track. So by the time I'm done with that process, if I've really worked hard at it, you know, step 10 to me is really, really important. And what I think about step 10 is that this is really where we get into this. You guys talk about it a lot and call it emotional recovery. I hear that term. I heard it earlier, and there's a movement on about stage two recovery, you know, where you've been sober and handled alcohol, now we'll go, you know, conquer the tough stuff. But, well, anyway, there's a lot of opportunities in, you know, from my experience in step 10 for, you know, growing emotionally. And the key to the whole thing for me is being honest about where I'm coming from in any given situation. Not with you, with me. Being honest with myself. And I'm a lot better than that than I used to. And so we get to the point where, according to the steps, that there is a spiritual awakening as the result of this process. And I think that that's been true for me. I think that there have to be different ways to describe and define what a spiritual awakening is. I don't think that there's a set path. I think that there are spiritual awakenings that take time. Mine was one of them. There are some that are quicker, but I do believe that at the end of the day, that's really the goal. And I can tell you that when I was newly clean and sober for the last time, that I was just a mess. I had cussed. I had stitches in my head. I don't remember what had happened, but I remember that I was in trouble with the law. I was angry as you could possibly be. I was unreasonable. People, I had no friends. My parents thought I was going to die. And ultimately, I was alone. I was completely alone. And I really thought that dying was better than living. And I did not care anymore. And that had been true for a number of years. And so, you know, getting to that point is kind of the end of the road. And that's before I really started to walk through this process while I was actually sober the whole time. And now I look at my life and I have a daughter that I love so much. I had my stroke and she would come to the hospital and see me every day. Be smiling, worried, concerned, 12 years old. And then I got out of the hospital and I got home. She was worried about me for the first few days. And then for about a month, she was just pissed at me all the time. She was just pissed. Now, that's being a teenager, I get it, but it was over the top. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And we were sitting at the dinner table one night, and I looked at her and I said, "Megan, are you mad at me because I had a stroke?" And she just started to cry. And she came running into my arms, and she said, "I thought you were going to die." Now, think about the honest and authentic expression of love in that interaction. And then, you know, kind of compare that to any doubt you have about, you know, whether there is a power greater than ourselves. And I think it kind of answers itself. It does for me, and I've seen what I believe is God in her through my life. Her innocence, her spontaneity, her authenticity, and all of that. What I'm going to see in the next few days, because I'm taking her to Chicago, are her manipulative efforts to get me to buy things for her at every store on Michigan Avenue. But I'm prepared for that. Whatever I try to do, it's not going to work. And to be able to go on a trip with my daughter to Chicago for a weekend is a total gift. And what I think at the end of the day is that I went through this process. I didn't change. What happened was is that these steps took away from me the things that interfered with my relationship with my higher power and restored me to who it is that He wanted me to be to begin with. And I think that's a gift. And I really do believe that that's happened in a number of ways. I have a relationship with my wife where we communicate and I'm able to listen to her. Oh, this is being taped. Never mind. Strike that. No, she's amazing. And she's very, very into life and into the world around her. And I admire her and I learn from her so much. I'm able to teach. I have close friends. These are not things that I own or that I can keep. These are things that have been loaned to me for what is a relatively short period of time. And over the last 2 years, I've seen this. You know, this is not a long-term project. We're here for, you know, very, very, very short period of time. I want to make the best of it. And I know that I was kind of knocked down by, you know, these events that I've shared with you. And they hurt a lot. I'm not going to lie to you. They hurt a lot. And, you know, a lot of people I've heard say, you know, I'm going to wait in the hallway for the next opportunity. I don't like waiting, but I know a door will open. My response to that is, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to go knock on the door, and where appropriate, I'm going to kick them in. So anyway, I have a great deal of admiration and respect for all of you. I am lucky to be sober and lucky to be alive, and I hope that my experience has touched at least one of you, that I can go to Chicago knowing that I've accomplished my mission. Thank you.